is 1897, and the fact that he has two granddaughters who are both here who are from is itself is a nace for someone to come in 1897. The fact that, I don't know, Sharon, your sister, how many, you know, her family, the fact that then you have your own grandchildren who are from now, so all the generations is quite amazing. And I think it was Bezuchus, his Torah, what he did. I don't know if people know this, but Sharon's grandfather is responsible for Lakewood, for the Ira Torah that is Lakewood. He was the one who brought Rabbaron Cutler, Zech Yitzchak Livracha, to Lakewood. He started the first shul in Lakewood. This, we could talk for hours about this. I'll let you ask Sharon and her sister afterwards. I think that the family is where it is today because of the Torah that he brought and he learned, and the fact that we're here learning Torah on his son, Sharon's father's Yurtzai, is quite remarkable. So the learning tonight should be L'Zecher Nishmas Yisrael David Ben Betzalel, and also Sharon's mother, Miriam Bas Yaakov Eliezer, and the Shama should have an Aliyah. It's very fitting that Rabbi Leibowitz is here because the day that Israel Goldstein passed away, it was the day that Rabbi Leibowitz made a bris for his oldest son, Yonah. And on that day, it was Rabbi Leibowitz's father, Billy Gortz, who drove Sharon and family back. Apparently, it was Kvitzas Haderech, and they made it back from Lakewood in like 10 minutes in time for Rosh Hashanah. So full circle for Rabbi Leibowitz to be here. I have a bio for Rabbi Leibowitz, but I'm not going to read it. I've always marveled at Rabbi Leibowitz for so many years. He's been successful in every aspect of chinuch, of teaching possible. High school, a college, smicha, camp, school, in person, online. The only thing that he hasn't yet done is taught a retiree kollel. So when we start our retiree kollel here, we have a standing invitation. I don't know if you will have to answer your father-in-law's questions, though. Not sure. It is a real zechus. I mean, Leibowitz is really responsible for the future of Orthodoxy because every person I know who's now in Smicha NYU, many students of mine and others, their Rebbe, every single one of them is Rebbe Leibowitz. So he's shaping the rabbinate and the future of Klal Yisrael, and it's a real zechus and a kavod to hear from you tonight.
Thank you very much.
I got a request.
Okay. Thank you so much, Rabbi Militsky, Bereshus, Marenu, Rabbi Luban, Shlita, Rabbi Militsky, the Marda Asra, Sharon and Harvey. As Rabbi Militsky mentioned, it is a very special privilege to be here for a number of reasons, not the least of which is to be here for the Atlas family. Considering our history and considering what this day meant, the day of Sharon's father's yard site, of his petira, I think there weren't that many people that were able to be Menachem Avel, because Rabbi Levitsky mentioned there was Kvitzas Haderech getting back from Lakewood on Erev Rosh Hashanah. Odie Shlomer, there's another pshat other than Kvitzas Haderech, but they made it back before Yantif. And we were zocha to be one of the few who made it to the house to be Menachem Avel that day, and the neshama should have an aliyah from all of the good things that Sharon and Harvey and their children and grandchildren do, and it's a tremendous credit to the entire family. Rishus, my in-laws, just another correction, you're assuming my father-in-law wants answers. You just have to listen. He doesn't necessarily want answers. He likes to ask the questions. It's a little bit nerve-wracking. I've spoken from this spot before, but I was 22 years old when I did so, and I didn't do a great job. So I'm the only other time I've done this. I didn't do as well as. So hopefully I'll be mechaper a little bit at this point. When you come to shul be'ezras Hashem on Kol Nidrei night. Imagine you're in this beautiful, very. I remember when this place was built. We spent so many Shabbosos here and so much time here. I remember davening in the old gym in RPRY, and then you come into a place like this, a beautiful Beis HaKnesses, a beautiful shul, and you come on Kol Nidrei night, and everyone is wearing their kittels and their talesim. And imagine you have somebody sitting in the back, somebody who maybe is not used to being in shul, somebody who is not accustomed to what's going on, and they hear hear the haunting tunes of Kol Nidre. They hear the tzibur getting into it and everyone seeming to connect to God in a serious way. And imagine that person who's not accustomed to all of this taps his neighbor on the shoulder. Not that there's any talking in shul, but he taps his neighbor on the shoulder and he says, "What are they saying? What is this all about?" How would you answer that question? Oh, it's about the vows that we may or may not have taken. So we are absolving ourselves of those vows that we may or may not have taken. And by the way, halachically, this method of absolving ourselves of those vows likely doesn't even work. But that's what we're doing on this most sanctified and holiest night of the year. Now, where on earth does that come from? Why would we do that on Yom Kippur night? There are many, many answers to this question. Perhaps the most pashut pshat, perhaps the simplest answer to this question is that it is an explicit Medrash Rabbah in Parshas Kisisa. The Medrash Rabbah tells us that Bnei Yisrael, in the aftermath of committing the grievous sin of the Chetah Egel, required kapara. And Moshe Rabbeinu tried to secure kapara for them, and he beseeches the Ribbono Shel Olam for kapara, and Hashem says, "I'm sorry, it's not an option. Kvar nishbati. I already swore that their sentence is sealed. It's done. There's nothing I could do about it. It's over." And Moshe Rabbeinu turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and he says, "Wait a second. You taught me Parshas Matos. And Parshas Matos begins with something called Hataras Nedarim. So you could take a vow, and yet the vow can somehow disappear. There are ways to make that go away. Lo yachel dvaro, aval acherim ochlim lo. Maybe you're not allowed to break your vow, but someone else can break your vow on your behalf. So maybe I can do that. Maybe I can be matir neder." And the pasuk says, Moshe Rabbeinu is on Har Sinai, the eshev bahar, and he sat on the mountain. Why is Moshe Rabbeinu sitting? Because dayanim be yeshiva. The halacha is that dayanim need to be sitting at the time of Hataras Nedarim and Balidin ba'amida. So Moshe Rabbeinu asks Hashem, "If you would have known that we are not perfect, would you have taken such a shavua?" This is all the Medrash. HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds, "Vayinachem Hashem." That Hashem regrets. He feels bad about the neder that he had taken. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, "Mutalach. You are now absolved of the shavua, and Klal Yisrael can live another day." And the Medrash says, and that's why Moshe Rabbeinu is called Ish ha-Elokim, Ish from a lashon of a husband, so to speak, because a husband has the right to be mefir nidre ishto, to undo his wife's vows. So too Moshe Rabbeinu was matir neder yotzro, the Medrash says. He was matir the neder of his creator. And that, perhaps, is the yesod of Kol Nidre. It's a reminder of our, not about our personal nedarim, but something majestic about Hataras and Hafaras nedarim that relates to the plight of Knesset Yisrael and indeed to the very survival of Knesset Yisrael. So all of that is not what I'm going to talk about tonight. I want to talk about something else related to nedarim that also, I think, relates to tshuva, and it relates to a particular path in tshuva that I would like to emphasize this evening. There is something else about the parshios of Hataras Nedarim that is very jarring. There's a Gemara that appears in two places, in Shas, in Kiddushin Daf Pei Aleph, and in Nazir Daf Chav Gimel. And the Gemara tells us that Rabbi Akiva was learning Chumash, and he came across the pasuk, "V'Hashem Yislach La," that Hashem will provide a slicha, Hashem will provide forgiveness for a woman who had thought that she had violated her neder. The case is, a woman takes a neder, her husband is made for the neder, gets rid of the neder, so she is no longer bound by that neder. But she doesn't know that. The husband did this without telling her that he has absolved her of this neder. So let's say the woman took the neder, she's not going to eat any more carbs, she's going to be gluten-free, whatever is the popular diet of the day, she takes this neder, and the husband says, you know, knowing his wife after being married for decades, says, this is not a good idea that she's going to be carb free forever. So he immediately is made for this biyom shamo. The second he hears about it, he's immediately made for the neder, but he doesn't tell her because she's going to argue and she's going to say, "What are you talking about? I really can do it, and I really and you know." And the wife is always right, so he just doesn't tell her about it. I was at a levaya yesterday. A friend of mine lost his father, and he told the story that he had called his father once, and he said, "Dad, I have two questions. The first one is a Shalom Bayis question," and his father said, "She's right. What's the next question?" Right. So the husband is not does not tell his wife that he was made for the neder, and then she cuts herself a nice piece of chocolate cake, and she eats the piece of chocolate cake, thinking that she's still bound by the neder. Says the Gemara, "VaHashem yislach la." God will forgive her. And Rabbi Akiva saw that pasuk and he began to cry. God will forgive her? She didn't even have a neder anymore. She only thought she had a neder. She wasn't bound by any real neder anymore. Why does she need slicha? Why does she need kapara? And Rabbi Akiva made a quick cheshbon in his mind, and he said, if someone who didn't even do an avera, but just thought they were doing an avera, requires slicha v'kapara, al achas kama v'kama, can you imagine the rest of us who, when we do averos, we actually are doing averos? It's not only a thought of an avera, but we're actually violating an avera. Can you imagine the amount of slicha and kapara that we require if we actually succeed in sinning? Now, this concept, the idea that a person needs a kapara, not only for actually successfully executing an avera, but even for doing something that at the moment that they're acting, they believe is an avera, is a concept that is somewhat jarring. And that's why Rabbi Akiva cries. It should not be confused with a concept that we're going to come upon in Daf Yomi very soon, in Kiddushin Daf Mem, where the Gemara tells us that machshava ra'a ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu mitzarfa l'maisa, that if a person thinks to do an avera, plans to do an avera, and doesn't actually succeed in doing that avera, well then, no harm, no foul, he didn't do anything wrong. You see, in that case, he never actually followed through and acted at all. He had planned to do an avera, but he didn't follow through with any action. So then, no harm, no foul. But if a person acted, and they did what they thought was an avera, they did what they thought was really a violation of something, such as a neder, so they were willing to go through with an action, that requires kapara. That is what caused Rabbi Akiva to break down in tears, to cry at that moment. VaHashem yislach la. Now, if one were to open up a chumash and find the pasuk VaHashem yislach la, you would find that there is not a pasuk that says VaHashem yislach la. There are, in fact, within a few psukim of each other, three times that the Torah says VaHashem yislach la. Pasuk Vav, Pasuk Tes, Pasuk Yud Gimel. And Rabbi Akiva quotes only the final one of those three psukim. The last of the three. We know which one he's quoting because the Gemara quotes the Hemshech of the Pasuk, the rest of the Pasuk as well. Quotes only the final of the three Pesukim. So the Achronim are bothered by the Kasha. If Rabbi Akiva is going to quote a Pasuk to highlight this point, and the Pasuk appears three times, why does he only quote the last of the three Pesukim? And there are several suggestions made by the Achronim. One suggestion is, well, the first two times that the pasuk is quoted is not really about a husband who undid his wife's neder, but is about a father who undid the neder of his daughter. And you see, when a father undoes the neder of a daughter, it functions differently. The mechanics of the hatara, of the hafara, are different than when a husband undoes a wife's neder. When a father undoes the neder of a daughter, there was a neder, but she's Bereshos Ha'av. She's under the father's jurisdiction. So even though she took the neder, he overrules the neder. But the Rush writes, when a husband undoes the neder of his wife, kol hanoderes al das ba'ala hi noderes. When she initially took the neder, it was only with the assumption that her husband would approve. And if her husband does not approve, the neder never existed to begin with. and Rabbi Akiva was highlighting just how severe a machsheves avera is, how severe a thought of an avera is, not only when a father undoes a daughter's neder, where the neder existed, it was just later overruled. Not only does that require kapara, but even when a husband overruled a wife's neder, where the neder never existed, kolano deres al das ba'ala hino deres. When she takes a neder, the whole thing hinges on the approval of the husband. And if the husband does not approve, there is no neder. And even so, she needs kapara because she thought she was violating a neder that never was. Not just a neder that she's been absolved of. This is the approach of the Divrei Shaul, Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson, in his commentary on Parshas Vayechi. There are other suggestions as well. But what we're trying to highlight right now is just how severe a machsheves avera is. It's a frightening thought when we think about the severity of what ultimately is really just a thought. A person thinks that they're doing an avera. They're not doing an avera. Not only that, it's an avera that never really existed, and it requires kapara. You can see why such a thing would move Rabbi Akiva to tears. But it's more than that. There is a Gemara in Maseches Kiddushin Daf Lamed Beis that talks about the following situation. This is literally Daf Yomi. Kiddushin Daf Lamed Beis talks about a father who wanted to test his son's midos. Not a good idea. But he wanted the holy Amorayim, they were able to do this. He wanted to test his son's midos. He wanted to see, would his son get angry at him if prompted to get angry? So what did he do? How do you anger your child? So you can wait until a pivotal moment in a playoff game of their favorite team and unplug the television at the last moment, right? That would be something that can really test whether they're how committed they are to the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim. So the father wanted to test his son, but they didn't have televisions, and probably Rabbah and Rafuna would not have had one if they did have televisions. So they had to come up with something else. So what happened was, Rabbah was the son of Rafuna. Rafuna wanted to test Rabbah's midos, so Rabbah decided he was going to take an expensive garment, he was going to take something, a cloth that had value, and he was going to tear it up in front of his son and see, will his son get angry at him? Will his son react to that act of tearing up this garment? The Gemara asks, wait just a second. You're not allowed to do that. V'dilma ratach. Maybe you'll test him and he'll fail the test. V'ka'avar mishum v'lifneiver lo siten michshol. And then you'll be in violation of lifneiver. You're prompting, you're baiting your child into doing an avera. That's cruel. That's evil. You're not allowed to bait a child into doing an avera. Think about that for a moment. How many times when our children get angry at us and we say, where's your kibud av v'aim? How many times did we bait them into doing the avera? Sometimes I may walk into my house with a scowl on my face. I had a rough day, and it's been difficult to deal with the things I was dealing with that day. And my child says, hi, Abba, not now. And then they react in kind. Where's your kibud av? Where's your kibud av? Where's my lifnei iver? Yeah, kibud av is a very important, kibud av aim is a very important mitzvah. If I were to make a top 10, I'd probably put it at like number 5 or so. You know, it's a, okay, last time I made that joke, no one got it, so you guys aren't educated. But it's a very, very important mitzvah. But if a parent baits a child into failing in kibud av, that's lifnei iver. So the Gemara asks, Dilma karatach, Rafuna, what are you doing? How can you do this? How can you bait Rabbah into doing an avera? He might get angry, and then you will have violated lifnei iver lo siten michshol. Now it's interesting, the Achronim, the Rishonim really, have a discussion. What if I try to do lifnei iver, I try to bait someone into doing an avera, but they don't take the bait? Did I violate lifnei iver? You know, the classic case in the Gemara is that there's a Nazir, and he's not allowed to have wine or any grape products, and I'm on the other side of a river, he can't reach the wine, and I throw the wine over the river to provide him with the wine. That's lifnei iver. He couldn't do it without me. I aided him in doing the avera. I helped him do the avera. That's the classic case of lifnei iver that the Gemara talks about in Sefer Zohar. What if I see the Nazir, I say, hey, you thirsty? He says, I could really use a glass of wine. Which, by the way, is a phrase that I didn't always hear growing up. I think that made its way into the Jewish lexicon, unfortunately, in recent years. I need a glass of wine. I need a drink. That was something it used to be that Nachrum would say. That was not something that that a Jewish person... Maybe it's just my impression. Maybe I grew up in the very pure Five Towns, so I don't know about this. But that's... I don't know. But a person, the Nazir, says, yeah, I need a drink. And then I throw him the bottle of wine. And, you know, he's a wine connoisseur. It's a really expensive bottle. He looks at it. He examines it. And he thinks for a second, and he's looking at his grown-out beard and hair, and he says, you know what? I don't need this. And he puts it down. He has the gevura, he has the koach to overcome his inclination, and he doesn't drink the wine. He didn't violate anything. What about me? Did I violate lifnei iver if he didn't do the aveira? So the Rambam in the Perush Mishnayos in Maseches Trumos discusses this. What if I tried to do Lifnei Iver, but the fellow didn't take the bait? Do I violate Lifnei Iver? Perhaps it depends how you read that Gemara in Kiddushin, which we're going to see in tomorrow's daf. The Gemara says, Dilma Ratach, how can you, Rabba, how could you, Rav Huna, rather, tear Rabba's clothing, tear the clothing? Dilma Ratach, he might get angry. V'kavar mishum Lifnei Iver lo sitein mikshol. And it will be a violation of Lifnei Iver lo sitein mikshol. Two ways to read that. One way to read that is, he might get angry, and if he does get angry, you will then have violated Lifnei Iver lo sitein mikshol. But if he doesn't get angry, you will not have violated Lifnei Iver lo sitein mikshol. There's another way to read it. Dilma Ratach, knowing that there's a possibility that he might get angry, you have already violated Lifnei Iver lo sitein mikshol. Whether he does or doesn't, that's his issue. But from your perspective, you've already violated Lifnei Iver lo sitein mikshol. It's machlokas achronim, how we paskin. Chazanish holds only if the avera is done, do I violate Lifnei Iver, where Chaim Moser says that no, just placing the stumbling block is enough, even if the avera is not actually done. It would turn out somewhat interesting. Think about it from a perspective of the Chazon Ish. Only if the avera is done do I violate Lifnei Iver. So I throw the wine to the fellow. Now I'm waiting to see. I feel a little bad. Now I'm waiting to see what's going to happen. If he drinks the wine, I violate Lifnei Iver. If he doesn't drink the wine, I don't violate Lifnei Iver. It could turn out that if he drinks the wine, he's actually in violation of two Averos now. He's in violation of his Nazirus, and he's in violation of Lifnei Iver on my Lifnei Iver. Because he is now causing me to violate Lifnei Iver. I wouldn't be in violation of Lifnei Iver if he didn't drink the wine. But now that he's drinking the wine, I'm in violation of Lifnei Iver. So he's actually violating the second Avera of a Lifnei Iver on my Lifnei Iver if he actually drinks the wine. But anyway, that's the Gemara's question. So the Gemara says, Rav Huna, what are you doing? You're not supposed to go ripping up clothing and testing your child. He might get angry, and it's a violation of Lifnei Iver. And the Gemara answers this question by saying, no, he was mochel. He was mochel. The father already in advance was mochel any anger that the child, any disrespect that the child was going to show to the father. He was mochel in advance. And kibbut ave'im is nitan l'mechila. You're able to be mochel kibbut ave'im. Kibbut ave'im is, Rav Shachter often points out, ritzono shel adam zeu kvodo. The nature of being mechabit another person is that you do what things that they like, and that's the kavod of that person. Rav Shachter, I remember, gave the example that when his back was hurting and he had a bad back, his children would help him put on his shoes because he had a difficult time putting on his shoes. When his back got better, if his children would put on his suit, would try to put on his shoes for him, he'd feel like kicking them. Why do you leave me alone? Don't put on my shoes for me. I'm able to do it myself. I'm not interested in that service. That's not kibbut ave'im if the parent is not interested in the service. Kibbut ave'im is nitan l'mechila. So already in advance, Rav Huna was mochel anything that Rabba was going to do to him. Tosfos, in a remarkable comment on the spot, says, not only was Rav Huna already mochel, but he must have told Rabba that he was mochel. Totally against the Pashup Shad of the Gemara. Because what are you really testing if you already told him in advance that you're mochel? But Tosfos says it has to be. It has to be that he told his son, I am mochel whatever you're about to do. And then he went and he took his son's favorite baseball jersey and cut it to pieces. Why? What forced Tosos into saying that he told his son he was mochel? Because if he didn't tell his son that he was mochel, he would be violating lifnei iver of machsheves avera. If the child does an avera, and I baited him into doing the avera, that's lifnei iver. If the child doesn't do an avera, but he thinks he's doing an avera, and I baited him into doing something that he thinks is an avera, well, then I violated lifnei iver on machsheves avera. So all of this is just to highlight how severe a machsheves hachet is. That Rabbi Akiva cried about the severity of machsheves hachet, about the fact that a person just thinking they're doing an avera requires kapara. We then pointed out that even if the avera in question is an avera that never existed, it was a neder that never even took hold, it was a neder that the husband was mefir, so it never took hold, still you need kapara. And now Tosos is highlighting, not only do you need kapara for machsheves avera, there's lifnei iver on machsheves avera. If you'll permit me, I'll tell you that there are three halachic nafkaminas, three halachic applications to this Tosos. There are probably more, but Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach in the Tshuva points out three fascinating halachic implications to this idea that there's such a thing as violating lifnei iver on machsheves avera. Imagine a pipe bursts in your kitchen, lo aleinu, and a woman calls the plumber to come to the house. The husband is at work at the time that the plumber comes. The plumber is male, and he shows up at the house, and the only one home is the woman. The husband is not home, he's at work. Happens to be, he works in Edison. He works in the city. That's a heter we call for an Isra Yichud Baila Bi'ir. That there's no Isra Yichud if the husband is in the city. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, when the plumber comes, the woman has an obligation to tell the plumber, by the way, my husband's in town. Why? She's not a violation of Yichud. The husband's in town. It's not a violation of Yichud. She knows that, but who doesn't know that? The plumber doesn't know that. And if the plumber doesn't know that, he's not violating an Avera, but he thinks he's violating an Avera. So if you don't tell him, by the way, you're not doing anything wrong, then he'll be violating Machsheves Hachet. And you will have violated Lifnei Iver on Machsheves Hachet. A fascinating nafkamina. Another possible nafkamina, Rosh Shlomo Zalman points out, happens every now and then. You suspect an employee of stealing from you. Or let's say a housekeeper. Right? It could be that the reason my fancy cufflinks keep going missing is because I'm a shlemazel and I forget them wherever I go and I never know where I put things. Or the interpretation I prefer is that the housekeeper is stealing them. So I want to know, why is the housekeeper, I want to know if she in fact is stealing from me. So I set a trap. What do? I get one of those cameras, very cheap nowadays, and I point it right at the table where I leave a $20 bill. And I'm going to see what happens. She's going to see the $20 bill. Is she going to put it in her pocket? Or is she going to just leave it there? I'm testing her. Now, I don't want to violate Lifnei Iver of Geneva. That would be terrible. So I'm mochel in advance. I'm mochel the $20. It's worth it for me. $20 investment is worth it to find out whether I can trust this woman. So I'm mochel in advance. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, you're not allowed to do that. Because while it may not be Lifnei Iver on Geneva, it's Lifnei Iver on Machsheva Sachet. She thinks she's violating Geneva. She doesn't know that you were mochel. And if she thinks she's violating Geneva, then you violated Lifnei Iver on Machsheva Sachet. One more halachic example, I'll get out of halacha soon. We'll get into Machsheva, I promise. But what, Bli Nedar. This is the last thing I need to make bad Nedarim now. But one more halachic example. The Chavetz Chaim in Hilchos Lashon Hara, Klal Dalet Os Yud Aleph, says, let's say I know that Reuven damaged Shimon. I saw it. I was walking right outside, and I saw Reuven slammed his car into Shimon's parked car. He knocked the mirror right off the side of Shimon's parked car. I saw it was Reuven. I saw it with my own eyes. I look around, and I realize I'm the only one that saw it. So I know that Reuven owes Shimon, whatever it is, a couple of $100. Nobody else knows that. I also know that if I tell Shimon what I saw, Shimon is going to take the law into his own hands and he's going to take his money back. He's going to find a way to take a couple hundred dollars from Reuven, the cost of the repair. He'll do it himself. He'll take his money back. Now the halacha is that if one person is meyid, if one person testifies that someone owes somebody else money, a court of Jewish law does not accept that testimony. Meaning, Shimon, I forget who's who already in the example, the guy whose window got knocked off, is not allowed to believe me when I tell him Reuven is the one that did it. And if he does believe me and he goes and he takes his money back, as far as he knows, he's in violation of an avera of stealing. Now, the truth is it's not stealing, because I know the truth. I know he's really owed the money. So he's not really stealing. Says the Chafetz Chaim, I may not tell him what happened if I believe that he's going to take the law into his own hands. By telling him what happened, I am not being machshel him. It's not lifnei iver on geneva. He deserves the money. It's lifnei iver on machsheves hachet, that he thinks he's in violation of geneva. So, wow. We have this concept of machsheves hachet. Machsheves hachet can apply even if it's an avera that never existed, and we now have expanded this category to lifnei iver on machsheves hachet. There's one problem with this whole picture. There's a comment of the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh in Parshas Vayechi, and a well-known story in Tanakh. That's just a fancy way of saying a story in Chumash. The ones in Nach aren't as well-known, but that's Rabbi Yisrael Reisman likes to say that nowadays, in general, if you ever want to be considered an expert at anything, you just have to know a little bit more than most people know. So nowadays, you know what we call an expert in, you know who's called an expert in Nach? Someone who can name all of the books. Right? That's enough already to be an expert in Nach. That's a little bit more than most people know. Okay, maybe that's an overly cynical take, but probably not untrue. The Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, commenting in Parshas Vayechi, tells us what happens. Yosef reveals his identity to his brothers, and then finally they live out their lives for the next 17 years, and everything's fine and peaceful, and then Yaakov dies, and the brothers are terrified. He's probably been biding his time, he's probably been waiting for the perfect opportunity to get back at us, the perfect opportunity to give us our just deserts for what we did to him. And they approach Yosef, and Yosef says to them, don't worry about it. I know you guys were chashavtem alai ra'a, but Elokim chashav letova. You tried to do terrible things to me. You wanted to kill me. You sold me down to Egypt. Horrible, horrible. But it saved Klal Yisrael. It was the best thing ever. This, by the way, is something that is worth keeping in mind as we daven on Yom Noraim. A lot of times things that seem terrible are actually quite good for us. Things that we think we want are actually the very worst thing for us. Rav Shachter often points out to us, Moreno Rav Shachter Shlita often points out to us, that Rav Soloveitchik used to always say that he would recall those bitter tears, the tefillos that he davened, that he shouldn't have to come to the treif in the Medina, that he shouldn't have to come to America, the Tamidei Chachamim that he was exposed to in Europe, the ability to interact with the likes of Reb Chaim Eizer and the likes of his father and his grandfather and the Sri Deish and all the people that he was able to interact with on a regular basis. And now he's going to have to come to America? What's in America? And he cried bitter tears that he shouldn't have to come to America. And Reb Soloveitchik used to say, and what would have been if those tefillos would have been answered? He didn't have to finish the sentence. We know what would have been. The same fate that met so many millions of others who didn't make it to America. Sometimes the things we want most are the things that we really don't need. And there's a certain sense of just submitting to the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Hashem, you know what's good for me. And therefore I'm davening, Elokim chashav letova. Yosef probably thought his life was over. He was being sold down to Mitzrayim. It's the worst thing ever. He was put in a position to save not only Klal Yisrael, but mankind. He was a tzaddik yesod olam. He saved the entire world. And that's how Yosef comforts his brothers. Says the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh on that pasuk, V'zakai b'dinei shamayim. And therefore the brothers have nothing to worry about, even in dinei shamayim. They do not have to give a din v'cheshbon after 120 years for what they did to Yosef. Don't worry about it. It turned out it was a great thing. What's the obvious kasha? Machsheves achet. They didn't know that. And then the Aruch Hayim HaKadosh makes it worse. And he says, I'll give you an example. Imagine you try to poison someone to death. And you accidentally give them a cup of delicious wine instead of a cup of poison. I may be dating myself with this reference. The Princess Bride. There are two cups. It does the thing, right? Okay, you all know, come on, right? I think I'm giving him poison. As it turns out, I'm giving him something delicious to drink that he enjoys. Says the Aruch Hayim HaKadosh, would you ever think such a person needs kapara? Of course you don't need kapara. That's fine, no problem. No problem? What's the Aruch Hayim HaKadosh talking about? We just went through machsheves achet. Even if the Averu didn't even ever exist, even if Naivir machsheves achet, it's so terrible. It causes Rabbi Akiva, who's a big laugher, by the way, it causes Rabbi Akiva to cry. And the Aruch Hayim HaKadosh says that that's no problem. So there are a number of approaches that are offered by different achronim. What time am I supposed to? I just want to know. I'm going to keep going. I'm not stopping yet, but I just want to know how to pace myself. 9 o'clock? 9:05? 9:10? 9 o'clock? Yeah, okay. Me and you, Sharon, we'll be here at 10:30. Okay. So a number of suggestions are made by the achronim. One suggestion is that if you do it, you're l'shem shemayim, if your intentions are l'shem shemayim, even though it was an aveira, then it's no problem. And the brothers acted l'shem shemayim, they put a beis din together, they thought they were doing a good thing. They didn't think they were doing an aveira. That's a great answer as far as the brothers are concerned. But remember, the Aruch Hayim dug himself deeper, because he then gave another example. And he said, if you think you're giving someone poison, and you accidentally give them wine, you also don't need a kapara. That's not l'shem shemayim, when you think you're giving someone poison. So that answer is not going to work. Another suggestion, Tshuvas Beis Yitzchak, Yerodei Chelek Aleph, and this is mentioned by the Kleisenberger Rebbe in his Tshuvas as well, that maybe it depends what the result was. I tried to do an Aveira. But what happened? What did I actually do? So if I actually did something that's neither a mitzvah nor an aveira, I need kapara for my machshava. But if what I actually ended up doing was a mitzvah, maybe the schar of the mitzvah is so great that it takes away any requirement, any need for kapara for the aveira. So if a woman thinks she has an eder, and she cuts herself that piece of chocolate cake, and she eats it, there's no mitzvah to eat chocolate cake. She thought she was doing an aveira, and instead she had a yummy dessert. But there is no mitzvah, so she needs kapara. The brothers thought they were selling Yosef down to Mitzrayim, doing this terrible aveira, but it turned out they were saving the world. It turned out they were doing a mitzvah. Again, we run into a little bit of trouble with the example of giving the poison and the wine. What, is giving wine to somebody a mitzvah? Maybe if it's Kiddush wine or Avdalah wine, but the Aruch Hayim HaKadosh never mentioned that detail. So there is a third approach that I heard from one of my Rebbeim, Rav Yonason Sachs Shlita. He pointed out that, in general, we love categorizing things in Torah. That's the way you're supposed to learn. Right? We categorize mitzvahs. There are mitzvahs sasei and mitzvahs lo sasei. There are mitzvahs taraisa and mitzvahs terabanan. So one such breakdown of categories is that there's such a thing as a result-oriented mitzvah and such a thing as an action-oriented mitzvah. Meaning sometimes I do a mitzvah, but it's not about the action per se, it's about the result that the mitzvah is meant to achieve. And sometimes there is no result it's meant to. When I pick up a lulav, what's the result it's meant to achieve? Just that I picked up a lulav. The action is it. It's the whole thing. See, when I give tzedakah to an ani, the result is that he's supposed to have food to eat. He's supposed to be cared for another day. He should have what he needs. That's a result-oriented mitzvah. When I build a makkah around my roof, the result is I have a safe home environment. So there's a result involved. But when I blow shofar, it's a maisa. I did the maisa, that's the mitzvah, that's it. The whole mitzvah's over. Maybe that distinction, which definitely exists, it exists, the Maharaj HaZura says, that's the secret to shlichus. Why is it that I can make a shaliach to be Mekadesh and Isha for me? Let's say a man is the example the Mishnah gives. So I wouldn't have thought of this as the classic example of shlichus, but the Mishnah in the beginning of the second paragraph of Kiddushin does. A man doesn't want to show up to his own wedding. It's not his fault. His favorite team finally made the Super Bowl. Imagine that the star quarterback didn't bust his leg on the first night of the season. And his favorite team that he's been waiting his entire life made the Super Bowl. They made the wedding on Super Bowl Sunday figuring, I'm a Jets fan, it's okay. Nothing's going to happen. But they made it. It was the year that they made it. And he said, I can't miss this. She'll understand. So he sends a shaliach to go be Mekadesh, the Isha, for him. It works. Shlichus works. I mean, he may have a hard time coming home that night, but shlichus works. Why does it work? Because the point of Kiddushin is not the act of Kiddushin. The point of Kiddushin is the result. You do an act to achieve a result, and the result is she is Mekudeshes. If you're ever under the chuppah, right after he gives the ring, they say, Mekudeshes. She is hereby Mekudeshes. So I can appoint a shliach for that. But let's say I want to sleep in tomorrow. I get home late tonight, they close down the Bell Parkway, Lo Aleinu, or something, and I get home very, very late, and I want to sleep in tomorrow. So I'm not going to have time to put on tefillin in the morning. I have to go say shir in yeshivas. So I'm not going to be able to put on tefillin. So I call my son up. I say, do me a favor. Put on tefillin a second time. Do one for me. Does that work? Of course not. Because it's a maisa-oriented mitzvah, not a result-oriented mitzvah. According to the Maror HaZohar, there are other explanations. But that's how there's this difference between a maisa and a result-oriented mitzvah. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach suggests that maybe that's the secret to mitzvah strichas kavana. That maybe the idea that you need kavana for a mitzvah is only when it comes to mitzvos that are maisa-oriented mitzvos. Meaning, this is a meaningful act only because I view it as a meaningful act. It's the act that's meaningful. So I have to have kavana for this meaningful act, says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. But maybe for a mitzvah ben adam l'chavero, mitzvos ain't tzrichos kavana. Maybe one does not require kavana for a mitzvah ben adam l'chavero. Why does he not require kavanah for mitzvah ben adam l'chaveru? Because it's result-oriented. I cared for the person, I gave him what he needed, I was mevaker cholim, I was menachem aveilim, whether I had kavanah for mitzvah or not. He had the nechama, he had the beaker, everything was good. So there is this difference between result-oriented mitzvah and maisa-oriented mitzvah. Maybe that's the answer to the Aruch Hayim HaKadosh, because the flip side of this is machshev asachet. If a person attempts to do something wrong, but it doesn't happen, maybe if it's a result-oriented aveira, it's a ben adam l'chavero aveira, nothing happened. There was no result. And if there's no result, there's no aveira. No harm, no foul. It's not a problem. I meant to give him poison. I gave him a delicious cup of wine. It's fine. It all worked out. There's no problem with handing someone poison. The problem is the result that achieves. There's no problem with doing a mechira with Yishmaelim. The problem is that the brother ends up out of the country being a slave to a bunch of Egyptians. And if the result was not bad, the result didn't happen, then it's no problem. I don't need a kapara. But maybe when it's maisa-oriented, like in the case of a neder, maybe then it's a different story. Maybe when it's maisa-oriented, since we don't care about the result. The question was your action. And my action was with kavana to do an aveira. For that, I need a kapara. Rav Yonatan Sacks said that he saw a sefer called Yesodos HaTzedakah. And he had come up with this chiddush, and he found this chiddush in the sefer Yesodos HaTzedakah. This exact chiddush. And he was so excited. You see, because in learning, see, if you try to patent something, you have big plans, you're going to go on the Shark Tank and you're going to have a new way to do something. And then, one of the sharks says, what are you talking about? I have it right here on my phone. You can get it on Amazon for $4. This has been thought of before, so you feel very bad. Someone else thought of it before. In learning, it's the exact opposite. If you think of a chiddush, and then you find that a gadol from a previous generation said the same chiddush, it means you're onto something. It means you probably got it right. If no one else said it, it's a very good chance that there's a reason that nobody else said it. There's a reason that Rabbi Kiva Eger didn't think of it. So it gets you excited. So Rabbi Sack said he saw in the Sefer Yisodos HaTzedakah this Chiddush, and he was so excited, and he saw it was footnoted. Ooh, which Achron is he quoting? And he saw it quoting Rav Yonason Sacks. So he saw, he's disappointed. I later found Rav Asher Weiss says the same Chiddush. So that's good enough. Now, what makes Rabbi Akiva cry? It's interesting. Rabbi Akiva, as I alluded to before, throughout Shas, laughs when other people cry. We have at least three examples in Chazal. Most famous is the Gemara at the end of Maseches Makos Tav Chav Dalid. All the Chachamim see a fox walking on the Makom of the Har Habayis, and everyone's crying and Rabbi Kiva's laughing. Another time, Sanhedrin Daf Kuv Yud, they went to be Mevaker Chola Rabbi Lazar, and again, Rabbi Lazar dying on his deathbed in extraordinary pain. And Rabbi Akiva's mitzachek. Rabbi Akiva finds the silver lining. Kol ma'da avid rachmana letava avid. Everything God does is for the good. He finds a way to smile and to laugh. And he realizes that the Yisurin Rabbi Lazar was experiencing was a way to pave a clear path for him in Olam Haba. And the third place, Yerushalmi Brachos Perek Tes Halach Gimel, a lesser known example. When Rabbi Akiva was put to death, he said Kriya Shema. But the Yerushalmi adds, v'gichech, and he smiled as he was being put to this gruesome death. There's another place where he laughs in Maseches Avodah Zarah, but he also cries in that place, so we're going to leave that one out for now. But three examples where everybody else is crying or would cry, and Rabbi Akiva laughs. And yet, in this one place, with a woman thinking she's violating a neder, a machsheves achet, and Rabbi Akiva cries. What's the secret to Rabbi Akiva's emotion? When does he cry and when does he laugh? Perhaps the answer is that sometimes people experience what the Gemara in Brachos Daf Yud refers to as Kavshi Derachmada, the Gezeros of Hashem, the things that we don't understand in life, the secrets of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when such things happen, Kol Ma Da'avid Rachmana L'Tav Avid. A Baal Bitachon, a Baal Emunah says, I don't see it right now, I don't understand it, I may never understand it so long as I'm living on this earth, but I know that kol ma da'avid rachmana l'tava avid. That's about things that happen to you. But when it comes to my personal responsibility, when it comes to am I going to do a mitzvah or am I going to do an aveira, to my own behavior, am I going to violate a neder or am I not going to violate a neder? I can't just say, oh, Hashem loves me no matter what, so kol ma da'avid mi l'tav avid. Everything that I do is for the good. No, not everything that I do is for the good. Rabbi Akiva cries. There's a sense, a profound sense, of personal responsibility when it comes to hashkachas Hashem, with emunah and bitachon, churban abayis, sickness. We understand that those are acts of God and therefore they're ultimately for the good. When I fall short, even in just a machsheves achet, I have to take that seriously. And that's really what this time of year is all about. But I want to highlight three other quick things, I'll try to make them quick, about machsheves achet. First, if machsheves achet is so terrible, we know that there's a klal in Judaism, mida tovas meruba mimida ra'a. The good side is always more powerful than the bad side. So good thoughts must be really powerful. And I think one thing to think about is what types of thoughts run through our mind. Not just what do I do? What do I occupy my mind with? What do I think about when things are quiet? If in today's day and age, with all the technology around us, you manage to find moments of quiet, what goes through my mind? I once saw an interview with Dr. Tova Lichtenstein, where she was asked about her father, of Soloveitchik, Zichron Levracha. And she was asked, like, you know, what did you see growing up? How did he become such a goon? How did he become such an incredible Torah genius? And she didn't start telling stories about strange behaviors, keeping his feet in buckets of ice to stay up late at night, or using every ounce of energy till he miscalculated and fell a drop short of his bed. These are inspiring stories about other gedolim. She said, no. My father went to sleep when it was time to go to sleep. He woke up when it was time to wake up. He ate when it was mealtime. You know what distinguished him? His mind was always occupied in learning. He was always thinking and learning. He was always growing. It wasn't when he closed the Gemara, okay, now I'm finished. I often tell my Talmidim, when you finish your Seder, walk away with something, a kasha, a shayla, something. Because you know what? Later that evening, you're going to be at a wedding somewhere, and you're going to find yourself standing next to a great Talmud Chacham. And what are you going to do in that moment? You know, after the chuppah, everyone davens Maariv, and you finish your Maariv, and there's Rav Shechter right next to you. So what are you going to say? Walk around with something. Carry with you a piece of Torah. Just carrying a piece of Torah with you, occupying our minds with such things. Rav Lapiansky told me once, Rav Lapiansky is, of course, Rosh Yeshiva and Yeshiva of Greater Washington, which that most people know. People don't realize that it's a K through Kollel Yeshiva. It starts with kindergarten, so he's officially in charge of the whole place. He doesn't have much to do with the middle schoolers, but something to do. He's their Rosh Yeshiva. So he's walking through the hall, and an eighth grader stops him in the hall, and the eighth grader says, Rav Lapiansky, can I ask you a shaila? He says, sure. And the eighth grader says, is it okay for me to daven that the Ravens will win the game on Sunday? Ravens are the football team in Baltimore, closest to Silver Spring. And Rav Lapiansky says, my immediate thought was, what a beautiful question to get. Because if someone is thinking about davening that the Ravens should win a game, it means that everybody who needs a Refuah Shleima already has one. Everyone who needs a Parnassa already found a job. Everyone who needs a Shidduch already has a Shidduch. He didn't say that to the 8th grader because it's excusable for an 8th grader to be thinking that way. But how many people still think that way when they're in their 20s and 30s and 40s? People half their age running around the football field, and that's what still occupies our minds. A second way to think about machshava and the power of machshava is how much do we occupy our minds with other people? A 12-year-old boy once asked Rav Lapiansky, he saw the kavod that was being shown to a particular visiting Rosh Yeshiva, and he said, how do you become a Rosh Yeshiva? It looks nice. Everyone stands for you when you walk in the room. Rav Lapiansky said, I told him that there's no maila in our tradition to being a Rosh Yeshiva. It doesn't say anywhere, it's none of the Taryag Mitzvahs that you need to be a Rosh Yeshiva. But you know what is in the Taryag Mitzvahs? That you're supposed to teach Torah. You're 12 years old. You're in a classroom with 20 other boys. You're a very bright young man. You pick things up quickly. Somebody else in that classroom maybe doesn't pick things up quite as quickly as you. You can't be a Rosh Yeshiva yet. You're 12 years old. But you could be better than that. You could be a Marbitz Torah. You can help the child who's having difficulty with his learning. What occupies our minds? Kleisenberger Rebbe once commented that the only mitzvah, Birchas Kohanim aside, the only mitzvah that has a makri, that has someone that, you know, heralds the mitzvah, that calls out to do the mitzvah, is Tkia Shofar. And Kleisenberger Rebbe says, V'zagam ha-remez b'masha no'agin la-hakros ha-seder at-kiyos l'fnei ha-tokeya ma-shalom ha-tzinu b'shar mitzvah shabitor. We don't find this in other mitzvahs. Lahoros al-inyan ha-achtus shekal echad mekabel al-atzmo me'achshav l'shmoa l'kol divrei chavero. That it is a moment where we take time to listen to somebody else before we act. And that's what it symbolizes. That call out of tkiyah, true, shvarim. Before I do something, I'm going to wait and listen to what someone else has to say. How much do we occupy our mind with other people? Rav Pam in Atar Lemelech says that if we say, Uchsov l'chayim tovim kol b'nei v'risecha, how can we possibly cause pain to another Jew when we're just begging Hashem to give chayim tovim, to kol b'nei v'risecha? But then there's a third thing that I want to highlight, and this will be the last thing that I highlight. Not only what occupies our minds, and not only do we think about other people, but how do we think about ourselves? You know, we live in a culture where everything's got to be out there. It's on social media. It's, you know, if there's no picture or video taken of it that the yeshiva can post to show their great success, then it didn't happen. And everything has to look perfect. Everything's curated to make everything look like I can be great and I can accomplish unbelievable things. And many of us can accomplish great things, perhaps. But if that's the goal, more likely we're not going to accomplish very much. The Jewish people, each Jewish person, has the ability to do what I would call big things, even if not great things. You know, I came to Yeshiva University 5 years ago. I noticed all over campus there were signs, leaders of tomorrow, growing the leaders of tomorrow, the brilliant leaders, this leader's that. My first Moser Shmuz in the Beis Medrash, I thought I was going to get fired. I said, we need some followers of tomorrow also. I mean, sometimes people can just be good, and that would be great too. Rav Lapiansky was once attending a graduation, and the Rashiva of the 8th grade, and you know, sometimes you have someone who's an excellent Rebbe in the 8th grade, but sometimes you have someone who holds that he's the Rosh Yeshiva of the 8th grade. So he asked everyone, a visiting Rosh Yeshiva came in, and he said, everyone, a Gadol Hador walked in, it was in Yerushalayim, said, everyone, stand up, everyone in the room, the Gadol Hador is here. Everyone stood up. And then he said, everyone sit down except for the 120 graduates. And everyone sat down. And he said, you know why I didn't tell the 120 graduates to sit down? Because among these 120, one of them is going to be the next Gadol Hador. And Rav Lapiansky said, I thought to myself, you have just admitted that you failed with 119 out of 120 of your students. Because if your goal is that they should be Gedolei Hador, you're inevitably going to fail with most of them. It's important to teach them, not everybody has to be great, but everybody can be big. Everybody can do big things. There was a father that was very, very hard on his child. And he had crazy demands. All of this is from one conversation with Rav Lapiansky. And he told Rav Lapiansky, you know, I'm so hard on him because I want him to be the next Rav Chaim Kanievsky. And Rav Lapiansky said, I have an idea. Instead of him being the next Rav Chaim Kanievsky, why don't you become the next Rav Chaim Kanievsky? Most of us aren't really capable of being great, but we convince ourselves that we are. And we set ourselves up for inevitable disappointment. There's a wonderful book called The Confidence Game. It's a book about how con artists succeed. It was written by a woman by the name of Maria Konnikova. I Googled it. She is not a tennis player, just an author. And she writes, of 1 million students who took the SATs in 1976, 70% thought they were above average in leadership ability, 60% in athletic ability, 85% of students put themselves above the average in their ability to get along with others, a full quarter going so far as to place themselves in the top 1%. In 1977, a full 95% of the faculty of the University of Nebraska thought that they were better than average at teaching, and yet they were at the University of Nebraska. Over two-thirds placed themselves in the top quarter, and it goes on and on. Interviews with people who caused terrible traffic accidents, and 80% of them think they are above average drivers. We're not so good at rating ourselves, at setting expectations for ourselves. And maybe that's why we say vidui so much. You would think that if we want to be zocha b'din, we should come to the Ribono Shalom and make our case. Hashem, look at Atzala, look at Bikur Cholim, look at Renewal, look at Misaskim, look at Tomchei Shabbos, look at all the great things that we've done, that Klal Yisrael has done. Look what happens if Rachmana Litzlan, someone dies young, how quickly the community gets together to take care of the family. Look at how we care for Yisomim and Almanos. But instead, what do? Ashadnu, Bagadnu, Gazalnu. Because maybe Hashem wants us to say, look, we aren't great, but we're ready to be big. We're ready to make that next step. And we can. I've seen it. There's a fellow in my shul, true story. It was later printed in Mishpacha magazine. I don't know if there was a reporter at the time that I told it. A guy in my shul called me up once and he told me that he's been working, he's in finance, he's an investment banker. And he was working on a deal for 3 or 4 years. It's one of those deals that make or break a career. I don't understand any of it. I was a finance major in college. I still don't understand any of it. But it was a make or break deal for his career. And they told him that the deal is going to be signed and sealed. It's going to be done in London on the Shabbos before Rosh Hashanah in a hotel on the Saturday before Rosh Hashanah. And he said, Shabbos? I can't do that. And they said, no. All the paperwork is going to be signed in advance. It's an hotel. All you need to do is walk into the conference room. Lawyers will be there. They're going to ask, do you agree, blah, 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 blah? And you'll say yes. And then they'll say, do you agree, blah, 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 blah? And you'll say yes. You just have to say the word yes 18 times, and that's it. Deal is done. He called me up and he asked, am I allowed to do this? This is my whole career. I did not want to be the one to tell him that you can't work on Shabbos, especially since I work on Shabbos. But I did not want to be the one to tell him that you can't work on Shabbos. So I said, you know what? This is above my head. I'm going to give you the phone number of a great posek. Not going to mention who it is now because I still don't understand the psak, but I'm going to give you a phone number of a great posek, a senior posek in America today, and you'll call him. I figured let him down. So he called this great posek, one of the gedolei poskim in America. And the fellow calls me back afterwards and he says, I want to tell you, I called the posek and he told me I can do it. He told me I can go and I could just say yes, yes, yes. He gave me guidelines, you know, you got to stay within, you know, in the hotel and, you know, how to navigate the issues. But he told me I can do it. But you know what? I'm not going to do it. I said, what? What do you mean? He said, I'm not going to do it. He said, I grew up hearing stories about how my grandfather would lose his job every Monday because he didn't show up to work on Shabbos. And two generations later, for a few extra shekels, his grandson is going to work on Shabbos? No way. I'm not going to do it. Of course, the story has a happy ending. You never actually have to be there. You can always sign over power of attorney and someone else. He's doing fine. But at the moment, now, is he a Rosh Yeshiva? Is he a Gadol B'Yisrael? Well, he goes to the movies like everybody else, you know? He's a regular guy. But there's moments of bigness. Rabbi Reisman told me that there was only one time he recalls that Rav Palm got angry at a Talmud. Rav Palm was not easy to anger. One time, an 18-year-old Bachar comes over to Rav Palm and he says, I'm frustrated because it occurred to me that at my age, the Chafetz Chaim was more advanced than I am right now. So how am I going to become the Chafetz Chaim? And Rav Palm got so angry. A chutzpah? Who do you think you are? Hashem gives a matana to a generation once every few centuries called the Chafetz Chaim? And you think you're going to be the Chafetz Chaim? Nuts? We don't have to be the Chafetz Chaim. We just have to be big. And the way to be big is by growing little by little. By doing something. Rabbi Yisrael Reisman told me it bothers him to no end when he hears people giving drushas, Yom No Rayim, and they ask the Kasha. Last year we said the same thing, that we're going to do tshuva and we're going to be good, and we're exactly the same as we were last year. And last year we were exactly the same as we were the year before. And Rabbi Reisman said, how are you not embarrassed to say those words? You're exactly the same? Then you shouldn't be the rabbi. What are you talking about? Most of the good things that I do were things that I picked up around the time of Yom Narayim. You pick up little things. Sometimes you strike out and they don't stick, and sometimes they do. Not exactly the same. So this is what I've been peddling around. This year, I gave 3 tshuva drushes yesterday. There were different drushes, but the same punchline. Here's the idea I'm peddling around. I heard from Rabbi Reisman. He said he takes every year 3 words of Shmoneh Esrei. And he makes those 3 words the words that he's going to focus on intensely in Shmoneh Esrei throughout that year. And every year he adds another 3 words. I started this a couple of years ago, and I can tell you the results are amazing. I'm embarrassed to admit how terrible my kavana was in Shmoneh Esrei. It's still not great. But great, great strides just by starting with 3 words. He got the idea because he davened next to Rav Elyashiv once, and Rav Elyashiv was hard of hearing, so he davened loudly enough that not only was he able to hear it, people around him were able to hear it. And he heard that Rav Elyashiv davened quickly, but then he slowed down and got super intense at the words, Hamachzir Shchinasam Letzion. He said 3 words. He was going to take upon himself, Hamachzir Shchinasam Letzion. And each year it's 3 more words. And he said, I have a big plan. I'm going to go up whenever the Ribbono Shel Olam decides to take me. Up in Shemayim. And he's going to say to me, you weren't perfect. You still didn't perfect yourself. And I'm going to say, I was busy working on it. Every year I took another 3 words. You took me too early. But I was on a path. I was doing it. That's all we need to be. We don't need to be great. We need to be big. We need to be growing. We need to be baderech. In our machshav, in the way we think about things, the way we think about others, what occupies our mind, but perhaps even most importantly, how we think about ourselves and how we think about our own growth. I wish everyone a tshuva v'chasima tova and a good kavanah shtiyah.